My name is Max, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may be better carry our message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Yasmin will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Yasmin, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. John will read the steps.
John, I'm an alcoholic. The 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Robin will read the traditions.
The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Tonight is the anniversary night, and we'll continue tradition speaker format until the end of the year. The format of the meeting will be: the 10-minute speaker will speak on the seventh tradition, our information break, the main speaker who will speak for 25 minutes, followed by our anniversary celebrants. Our 10-minute speaker is Helen.
Good evening, everyone. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Helen. And I so don't want to be up here doing this. I really think, no, I'm serious. I think there's so many more people far more capable of doing a better job on the seventh tradition. I turn people down quite a bit when they ask me to speak on the traditions and on the steps. And, you know, some people have it to teach and others don't. And, you know, you have to know when to fold them. So I'm up here. I'm up here under duress, and I was overruled, so we're going to give it my best shot. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. No AA tradition had the labor pains this one did. Collective poverty, initially a matter of necessity. Fear of exploitation, necessity of separating the spiritual from the material. Decision to subsist on AA voluntary contributions only, placing the responsibility of supporting AA headquarters directly upon AA members. Bare running expenses plus a prudent reserve is headquarters policy. So, you know, I've been doing a little investigating on this, and somebody told me that GSO is no longer going to be supported through monies from our publishing of AA literature. So rather than come up here and tell you this, I thought I'd call GSO first. And I'm glad I did, because it's wrong. Huh? You know, they're talking about this. So I said to the guy, so not in our lifetime, right? And because I'm told to get anything changed in a pamphlet in GSO, it takes 7 years. You imagine, one little thing. So probably not in our lifetime. Anyway, what I found and came to believe I really liked. A big factor in our thinking at the time was the philosophy of St. Francis of Assisi. His also began a lay movement, one man carrying individuals to pledge themselves to poverty. But it was unusual, if not unique, for the whole organization or fellowship to do the same thing. For the purpose of his society, Francis thought corporate poverty to be fundamental. The less money and less property they had to quarrel about, the less would be the diversion from their primary purpose. And just like AA today, his outfit did not need much money to accomplish its mission. Why he tempted and diverted when there was no need for it. Despite early traditions of keeping AA poor for its own safety, we were still to have temptations. There were three of them. The first came when Mr. John D. Rockefeller Jr. and his friends in the fall of 1937. Of course, that was the big dinner party when Bill Wilson and company had hoped for a major payday from about 400 friends from the Rockefellers. And at the end of that party, Rockefeller supposedly said, money is going to destroy this thing, and gave them a $5,000 check, much to the disappointment of Bill Wilson and company, but probably why we're still here today. The second temptation veered to the other extreme. We got so scared of money that we went tightwad, half refusing to support AA's simple but essential area over all services, without which we would fail to function and grow. Even now, we haven't quite surmounted this one. We still drag our heels when the hat is passed to support our local intergroup offices and general headquarters. When I came in, I was pretty broke. And I made 5 to 7 meetings a day. And I put something in every basket at every meeting I went to, whether it was a quarter, a dime, 50 cents. Because what this program was doing for me, there was no dollar amount I could have put on it. I could not pay. I could never live long enough to pay a dollar amount back to this program for what it's given me today. But yet, it's none of my business when I see the basket go around and I see somebody pull up in a cab and jump out of it to come in and take their rightful seat at a meeting and just pass the basket to the next person without putting nothing in. And when I talked to Van about that, he said, it's none of your business. And I said, yeah, but did you hear what I said? They took a cab to the meeting. He said, did you hear what I said? It's none of your business. So I try to practice that today. I don't always succeed, but I practice. Our third temptation was the greatest peril of all. Oh, I can imagine what this was like. One night, the trustees of our foundation were having their quarterly meeting. The agenda included a crucial question. A certain lady had died, and when her will was read, it was discovered she had left to Alcoholics Anonymous in trust $10,000. Should AA take the gift? And up one side and down the other, as much as they needed the money, they said no. And they set up guidelines from that point on. And they put limits on what people could donate if you're an alcoholic and what you can leave if you're a non-alcoholic. Now, it's not to say if you have $10,000 and you want to throw it in the basket anonymously, you can. But don't tell anybody you did it. And that's what's okay. It's not okay for you to leave it in trust for us from you. I had an experience at the Bill Wilson House this year. Last year there was a boat party, and there was money left over from that, and we took the money from that and we divided it up in three. We took some for Stepping Stones, we took some for Dr. Bob's house, and we took some for the Bill Wilson house. It was a non-AA event, and they're not affiliated with AA. I don't quite get that myself, but that's what I'm told. So we divided it up between those three, and somebody said, Helen, when you go up to the Wilson house, you should introduce yourself as you know, part of the Big Apple, blah, 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 and you know how this year we'll be sending them even more money. And I so did not want to do that. And this person insisted. So I went up to Bonnie and, you know, did as I was told and said, I'm, you know, with the Big Apple, and, you know, we'll be sending more money this year. And she said, oh, that's great. You know, your money was so appreciated, and, you know, we really need it, and, you know, times are tough up here right now. And so I said, okay. And I tell you something, because I did that, I attached myself to that money. And I was up there that weekend looking at that house like I never looked at it before, and I saw so much waste. And I saw so many ways money could be saved, starting with the toilet paper roll. I kid you not. And I wanted to go up to Bonnie at the end of that weekend and tell her that they should get this kind of toilet paper roll because it won't just keep running. You know, it'll give you what you need. And I said, Helen, mind your business. And I did, so thanks.
And tonight, our main speaker is David.
My name is David. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And I should say I'm a recovered alcoholic and an addict. I was at a meeting on Friday. Yeah, I'd never been to that meeting before. And I was sitting in the back. I wanted to just relax and chill out. I hadn't been to a meeting in a day or so. And most of my meetings, my home group's Pompano Beach Group in Florida. And the meetings were a little different up here. And I'm sitting in the back, and all of a sudden, a woman sitting in the circle at this meeting suddenly pipes up and says, you know, I've been in the program a long time, and I hate people that say they're recovered. So immediately, my hand shot up. I am a recovered alcoholic. The big book says that we are about 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And when I came into this program, I was in a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. You want me to qualify as to how I came into this program, share my experience, strength, and hope? I got lost in a bottle and I was found in AA. That's my whole story. You can fill in all the blanks. I'll give you some of the blanks. I went to my first meeting in 1970. And this was in England. And a friend of mine called me and he said he'd spoken at the last dinner that Bill Wilson ever gave in Miami. And he said to me, you know, Bill Wilson just died. I'm going to do a eulogy. You want to come out here and hear me? And I said, for this, and I said, you know what? If Bill Wilson's going to die, I was all of like maybe 22, 23 years old. If Bill Wilson's died, there's not much point in me staying sober because I'm going to die anyway. And I'm a kid. I'm going to drink. It took me over 10 years to get back in this program. And here's what I can tell you about being out there, and I'll tell you some of the war stories. But what I can tell you is this. In all the times I came in and out, and I don't believe in relapsing, I just wasn't done drinking till I was done. When I was done, I was done. And that's what the old-timers would tell you. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and one of his sponsors over the years was Clarence Snyder. For those of you that don't know, Clarence was at that dinner you were referring to. And I've never quite understood why they give 10 minutes to the traditions and 30 minutes to somebody speaking about the steps and their program when, you know, the steps are about me not killing me. And the traditions are about me not killing all of you. You'd think it would be the other way around, wouldn't you? But thank you, Helen. And so I came into the program, and I do have a sponsor. And I started going to meetings, and what I learned was this. If sponsors could keep you sober, there wouldn't be a person here that would relapse. If the big book could keep you sober, nobody would ever relapse that had a big book. If medallions could keep you sober, anniversaries could keep you sober, nobody would ever relapse. If working the steps could keep you sober, nobody would ever relapse. There's only one thing that will ever stop you relapsing, and that's using all those tools to get a relationship with a higher power. Now, they told me I couldn't talk about drugs, so I'm not going to talk about drugs. So I'm going to talk about elephants, penguins, gorillas, and about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sure you've all been through the steps. But let me tell you a little bit about how I got to this program. My mother, at the age of 12, escaped across Europe. They managed to get her a student visa. Everybody else in my family died in the Holocaust on that side of my family. My mother got to England. And she got out alive. And when she got out alive, she caught TB during the air raids. Contracted TB, and she's 82 years old and still functioning and still alive. God bless her. And my father is still alive, too. He was the youngest of 10 kids. She was an orphan. So that had the makings for a great family relationship. He had done nothing in his life. Everybody did everything for him because he was the baby of the family. And she did everything in her life because she was the only one. So they were both focused on each other their whole lives, and I grew up somewhere in the middle, and I was an only child. At about 12, I went to high school. I should tell you that my elementary school, my family's Jewish, they sent me to a Catholic school. For my high school, they sent me to a Church of England school. They wanted to round out my education. And when I was about 13, they sent me to Bar Mitzvah, which was sort of unusual because I'd never read a word of Hebrew in my life. I managed to get through that, and I started drinking around that age. But I want to start a little earlier. When I was 3 years old, they discovered I had asthma. And they took me to a doctor. And the doctor said, I'm going to give you this little pump. And every time you want to change the way you feel, when you're panicking, when you can't breathe, I want you to use this little inhaler. Well, you know, the fact is, they say that feelings are not facts. But the fact is, I drank to change the way I felt. And the first time I used that inhaler, the very first time, it changed the way I felt, and I could manipulate everybody and everything around me, and I never looked back. And when I found alcohol, and by the way, we're no different. It's been like this all through history. one of the first things you should do that I was taught to do when I came in this program was get three books. I was told to get a dictionary, a big book, a dictionary, and a Bible. And when I said, what do I want a Bible for? I'm not a religious person. They said, because this program came from the Bible. That's where they took this program from. Read it as a story. You don't have to read it as a religious thing. Just read it as a story and understand where they got all these concepts from. Just understand where they got the concepts from. So I opened up the book. First story is a man called Adam. Adam's here on the planet. God creates this wonderful planet. Now, I'm pretty sure he didn't create me to come down here and destroy everything on the planet like we're doing. So he must have a reason for me being here. And the reason was, very simply, I saw the story of Adam. He used to walk and talk with him. He wanted a relationship with him. I believe that there's a higher power in my life, that this program has shown me how to have a relationship, that wants to have a relationship with me. So Adam can do everything except one thing. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know about you, but I can do anything except one thing. Because when I pick up that drink, all bets are off. So Adam does that one thing. God comes down and says, why'd you do it? What does Adam say? She made me do it. And it's never changed. That's the story of my life. The story of my life, it was people, places, and things. It was everybody but me. I lived my whole life in denial. It was everybody else's fault why I got drunk. I knew how to. There's not a person here that doesn't know how to stop drinking. You do not need to come to AA to learn how to stop drinking. I either blacked out, was thrown out, or passed out. That's how I stopped. What I couldn't do was stay stopped. That's what AA has done for me. I came here to learn how to stay stopped. And the first time I came here in 1970, it ruined my drinking. Destroyed my drinking, because I always knew there was another solution. See, I'm an alcoholic. Alcohol's not my problem. It's my solution. And when I gave up the alcohol, I was left with a problem and no solution. And that's when you talk about drugs, that's when you talk about food, that's when you talk about sex, that's when you talk about gambling, all of these other things that we alcoholics turn to for comfort. Because we don't have any comfort and we don't like to feel the pain. That's why we drink. We drink to change the way we feel. So there I am. I'm now in high school. I'm drinking regularly because in England in those days you could. I used to go to rugby games when I was about 14, and you could go to the pub afterwards and people could buy you drinks. And I played rugby. And by the time I was 18, I was a full-blown alcoholic going into college. And I got into college as a full-blown alcoholic, and somehow or other I got through college as a full-blown alcoholic. And during those times, between the ages of 14 and 21, 22, I learned to drive. And the sum total of learning to drive was three car accidents, seven cars total, 15 people put in hospital, and I walked away without a scratch. So I look at the second miracle of my life. I've got a mother who shouldn't be alive, and I was born to that woman. And I've been in three car accidents where seven cars were total, 15 people were in hospital, and I walked away without a scratch. That, when I look back at these things in my life, I know that there was something keeping me alive. And I'll get to that later. So anyway, where am I? Oh, yeah, I'm at the driving stage. I then go into business. Well, of course, like everybody else here, I'm sure you know how to run your boss's business better than you do. Better than he does, I mean. And better than you do, probably. But, you know, in my first two jobs, I told them how to run their companies. And you know what? I got real high in those companies, and then I eventually talked myself out of those jobs. I was too good for them. I needed a better job. And I acquired things over the years. And in the process of acquiring those things, the ego and the self-esteem, the low self-esteem, you know, we're egomaniacs with low self-esteem. That's me. The more the ego climbed, the lower the self-esteem went. The higher the self-esteem went, the lower the ego went. I actually don't have, I'm not sure that I ever have had humility. My humility came when my low self-esteem and my ego sort of equaled out at some point. Just for a moment. And that was probably when I did my fifth step. For a moment. So, really? So, it's lucky I can read. So, the bottom line on that is, I got through those things, and through my work, I got my ego going, and I ended up getting into a business where I decided with some friends that we were going to get into a business supplying special forces with certain types of weapons. The result of that was two bombs for my on my life, which I recorded in the press. The IRA didn't. They really took exception to the fact that we were supplying special forces with these weapons. If any of you are Irish out there, I've made my amends already. And those two bombs killed five people and injured 104 people. And again, I walked away without a scratch. And I was in one of the places when the bomb went off, and I was no more than 5 feet away, 10 feet away from it, I should say. And in the other place, I wasn't even there. I just read about it in the newspaper. But I was supposed to be there with my partners, and we had canceled the meeting. And at that point, it started to get to my attention that something was not right, that I was not doing things right. And the reason was because I would drink, and it would give me all sorts of courage to do all sorts of things. It's an interesting thing, you know. I have this... I don't know if you know the story. There's a story about a man who's done everything in life, and he wants to do this ultimate thing, and somebody tells him that there's a place you can go where you can have the ultimate sexual experience. So he goes there, and they open up the door, and they push him inside, and there's nothing in there but a gorilla. And he says, wait a minute, there's nothing in here but the gorilla. And he said, yeah, that's the sexual experience. You have sex with the gorilla. He says, well, how do I pay for this thing? They said, well, we give the gorilla a piece of chalk, and when you have sex with the gorilla, put a mark on the wall. So they close the door, and half an hour later, they go back in the room. And the guy is lying there, passed out on the floor, and the gorilla's jumping up and down, screaming, more chalk, more chalk, more chalk, and there's marks all over the wall. That's what I have. I have a 400-pound gorilla, and when I was down to my very last bit, that gorilla's screaming, more chalk. That gorilla wants every bit of me. That gorilla wants every piece of me. It's an interesting thing. It's an interesting thing. Everybody's silent because they've all got a gorilla, right? Every one of you's got a gorilla that wants more of you than you want to give. It'll take you out and then leave you on the floor. Penguins. Actually, I'm terrified of talking in front of people. So actually, you know, how I do this is like, you ever seen the movie Happy Feet? Happy Feet, where Mumbles and he's singing, but it's not really him. There's a little penguin behind him. Well, I have a 4,000-pound elephant behind me. And when I open my mouth, the elephant speaks. I got that elephant in these rooms. You know, it's that elephant that none of you want to talk about that's in your living room. It's the elephant that's at your work that you're afraid to talk about. You know, that God thing? So, I came into these rooms and they said you can work the steps. I got into these rooms January 1, 1980. They said you have to get a sponsor and work the steps. I got a sponsor. Started to work the steps, and this is what he said to me. He says, this is what the steps, this is how they are. This is what you're going to be doing. Step one is, I'm screwed up and I can't fix me. Step two is, all of you are just like me. You're all screwed up, so none of you can fix me either. See, that was my problem. I wanted you guys to fix me, and you couldn't. Step three is, God could and would if he was sought. Steps 4 through 7 is, clean house, because why would God want to live in the crap house that I created? Steps 8 and 9 is, make restitution. Nobody wanted to hear I was sorry. They wanted me to do something about it. Steps 10 is 4 through 9 on a daily basis. 11 is 2 and 3 on a daily basis. And 12 is 1 on a daily basis. Because every time I do a 12th step like this is a good example, or a 12th step call, I have to admit to that other people or people, person, that I'm an alcoholic. My life is unmanageable at times, and I need help to do it. And this is how I get the help. I get on my knees every morning, and I ask God for help. And somehow or other, that elephant reaches down and picks me up and carries me through the day. And I haven't got a clue how I've stayed sober for almost 29 years. Not a clue. Except I do these things. I get down on my knees in the morning. I ask God for help. I thank him at night. I've worked the steps. I have sponsees. I do what the program suggests. They never used to be suggestions, by the way. They used to be directions. And they used to say, if you get to the end of the part that they always read in groups, like where it says how it works, there are three pertinent ideas, A, B, and C, which are steps 1, 2, and 3. The third step being, God could and would if he was sought. The faith step. When they get to that point, the next line that they never read is, being convinced, we're now at step 3. Huh. Being convinced of what? That God could and would if he was sought. If you're not convinced and you're having difficulty staying sober, you probably know why. So God could and would if he was sought. The problem is, where'd you find him? Well, I found him just like this. You know, I used to spin all the time. And one day, I'm listening to how it works, and it says, we stood at the turning point, and I thought, what do you do when you stand at the turning point? What you do when you're standing at the turning point is make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And instead of spinning, I turned 180 degrees, and that God that was behind me, that picked me up every time I fell over, was now in front of me, between me and my next drink. And that's exactly how I stand sober today. And by the way, I do not have a God that I understand. This is a spiritual program, not a religious program, for those of you that don't understand the difference. A spiritual program is one where a man sits in a fishing boat thinking about God, fishing. And a religious program is one sits in a church pew thinking about going fishing. I don't know where your heads are tonight, but maybe that'll make you up. So, you know, we get to a point where we don't think about drinking anymore. I honestly don't think about drinking. I want you to know something. I'm an alcoholic. My first option is always to drink. It's not my choice anymore. It's out of the area of my choices. Unless I start doing what I see people doing all the time. You want to know if you're in danger of relapsing? I'll give you a very simple solution to see if you're relapsing. I haven't met a person yet. I'll give you two things that I've learned in this program. Number one is, in 40 years of being around these, almost 40 years of being around these program, around this program, in several countries, I've never yet met a person that relapsed that wasn't sober 30 seconds before they relapsed. So if you're sitting in these pews and you're sober, be warned, be vigilant. The second thing that I know about staying sober is that you have to do what the program suggests. It's not my program. I don't have a program. My program nearly killed me, and it'll certainly kill you. There's a program in these books. I went through it in 6 weeks. Clarence went through it. There's an interesting story about Clarence. He went to a friend of mine was chairing a meeting up in South Carolina and asked Clarence to come and speak for him, and he went down there and spoke. Clarence died in 83. He went there and spoke, and at the end of the meeting, somebody said to him, well, what did you do before you had a big book, Clarence? And he said, well, a lot of the times we read Sermon on the Mount. He said, oh, I know, Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox. He said, no, that would be Sermon on the Mount by Jesus Christ. They didn't make any bones about what this program was about. This program is about finding a power greater than yourself that will restore you to sanity and put your life back together again. The only problem is it's a program about relationships. We like to isolate. Let me tell you about my last night drinking. My last night drinking was the doctor told me in London that I was going to die. I went to my home and I started to drink, and I was doing some other things as well. And I'm looking out the curtains. Now, I'm sure none of you have ever done this, to look out the curtains to make sure nobody's watching you. That may not sound too insane to all of you, except for the fact that I lived on the only house on an island. And the following day, I called my sponsor when I came to, the person who was going to be my sponsor, and I called him and I said, I'm coming out to the States, I need to get sober, and I flew to Fort Lauderdale. And I flew to Fort Lauderdale on Christmas Day because I knew the bars would be shut in England, and that if I flew on a plane on Christmas Day, I'd be able to drink for 9.5 hours. And I arrived in Fort Lauderdale blind drunk and went out and partied for 5 days before I called him. And when I came to in my house 5 days later, I called him and I said, I'm ready. You see, there was only one reason I got sober. I didn't get sober because I didn't want to drink anymore. I'm an alcoholic. Of course I wanted to drink. I got sober because I wanted to live more than I wanted to die. I was convinced, finally convinced, that I was going to die. And we die in progression. We die spiritually long before we'll ever die physically. Let me tell you why I don't drink today. One of the reasons I don't drink today is because for me to pick up a drink is suicide. Because the first thing I do is I'm just like Adam. I disconnect myself. It's a program of relationships. I disconnect myself from my higher power the minute I take that first drink. And the minute I disconnect myself, I'm already at a spiritual death. And from then on, it works towards a physical death. Because I don't have anything to keep me sober. I have nothing between me and my next drink once I've got broken that spiritual connection. So I'm 6 months sober. I'll shorten this now. I'm 6 months sober, And I have to go on a sales trip. And this is like 6 months after I first came in the program. I got sober in 6 weeks. I did my step. And today, by the way, I take people through the steps in as little as half a day. Clarence started a program called Came to Believe. And we take people through the steps in half a day. And we do it all over the country, including up here in New York State. I think it's Buffalo, the last one they did. So I go on this sales trip, and I'm in a Holiday Inn somewhere, and I'm with another salesman who's you know, he drinks, and I'm 6 months, and I'm trying to stay clean, and I'm getting on my knees every morning, and I'm doing everything I can, and I'm terrified I'm going to drink again, and I'm terrified I'm going to die because the doctor told me I was going to die if I kept drinking, and I believed it, and I've buried enough people in this program to know that that's true in the previous 10 years. So I get up and I start making my bed because my sponsor said, you know, you're an alcoholic. You're really undisciplined. He said, I'll tell you what to do. You get on your knees every morning. And if you don't know how to do that, you make your bed every morning. And while you're making your bed and you get down on your knees and you fold on the ask God for help. I still do that today. I still do that today, every day. So I get up in the morning and I'm making my bed. And the guy is in the next bed to me and he says, looks over. He says, what the hell are you doing? I said, I'm making my bed. He said, I can see that. We've got room service. I said, well, you know, it's just something I've got to do. So I make the bed, and I say, you know, in silence, I'm saying, God, you know, the usual, the third step, seventh, you know, I get myself prepared for the day, ask God for help, go in the bathroom, take a shower, I'm reading some you know, something out of the 24-hour book. I come out, and there's this guy, Joe, and he's making his bed. And I said, Joe, what are you doing? He said, I'm making my bed. I said, I can see that. Why are you making your bed? He said, I don't want room service to think we're gay. Rule 62, don't take yourself too seriously. And if you don't know where Rule 62 is, you need to do some more reading. This is a great program. You know, this is a great program. I've seen a lot of people die, 13 this year that I know of. And Paul, I think Paul can verify. My friend Paul came up from East Hampton. He's a friend of mine from Florida, and he was in the Hamptons and came out to see me today and some other friends. And where else could you go when you're 1,000, 1,500 miles away from home and friends will come and talk to you and see you because you're out that night? There's no other program I know like it. So, you know, stick around, guys. If you're new to the program, find somebody that's got some time. And I'll finish with this. You know, I hear all sorts of myths in this program. One of the greatest myths I've ever heard is, you can't date anybody for a year. That's absolute crap. Let me tell you how it works. Let me tell you how the old-timers will tell you how it works. It works like this. You don't date anybody till you've got a relationship with a higher power, because you can't recognize somebody else with a relationship with a higher power. And if the two of you don't have a relationship, both of you with a higher power, you don't have a relationship that will last. Whether it takes 1 week, 1 month, 1 year, or 10 years, until you've got a higher power, you know what happens? What happens is two flakes make a blizzard. Thanks.